asked Sir Eustace, turning with a smile to his secretary. For some reason the question seemed to disconcert Mr. Paget. He stammered and flushed. "Oh, quite so, yes, quite so." Then, with a muttered excuse, he rose and left the table.
"I am beginning to suspect Guy Paget of having committed some dark deed in Florence," remarked Sir Eustace, gazing after his secretary's retreating figure. "Whenever Florence or Italy is mentioned, he changes the subject or bolts precipitately."
"Perhaps he murdered someone there," said Mrs. Blair hopefully. "He looks, I hope I'm not hurting your feelings, Sir Eustace, but he looks as though he might murder someone."
"Yes, pure Cinquecento. It amuses me sometimes, especially when one knows as well as I do how essentially law-abiding and respectable the poor fellow really is."
"He's been with you some time, hasn't he, Sir Eustace?" asked Colonel Race.
6 years,"
said Sir Eustace with a deep sigh. "He must be quite invaluable to you," said Mrs. Blair.
"Oh, invaluable. Yes, quite invaluable."
The poor man sounded even more depressed, as though the invaluableness of Mr. Paget was a secret grief to him. Then he added more briskly,
"But his face should really inspire you with confidence, my dear lady. No self-respecting murderer would ever consent to look like one. Crippen, now, I believe, was one of the pleasantest fellows imaginable."
"He was caught on a liner, wasn't he?" murmured Mrs. Blair. There was a slight rattle behind us. I turned quickly. Mr. Chichester had dropped his coffee cup. Our party soon broke up. Mrs. Blair went below to sleep and I went on deck. Colonel Race followed me. "You're very elusive, Miss Bedingfeld. I looked for you everywhere last night at the dance." "I went to bed early," I explained. "Are you going to run away tonight too, or are you going to dance with me?" "I shall be very pleased to dance with you," I murmured shyly. "But Mrs. Blair..."
"Our friend, Mrs. Blair, doesn't care for dancing."
"And you?"
"I care for dancing with you."
"Oh," I said nervously. I was a little afraid of Colonel Race. Nevertheless, I was enjoying myself. This was better than discussing fossilized skulls with stuffy old professors. Colonel Race was really just my ideal of a stern, silent Rhodesian. Possibly I might marry him. I hadn't been asked, it is true, but as the Boy Scouts say, be prepared. And all women, without in the least meaning it, consider every man they meet as a possible husband for themselves or their best friend. I danced several times with him that evening. He danced well. When the dancing was over and I was thinking of going to bed, he suggested a turn round the deck. We walked round 3 times and finally subsided into 2 deck chairs. There was nobody else in sight. We made desultory conversation for some time.
"Do you know, Miss Bedingfeld, I think I once met your father. A very interesting man, on his own subject. And it's a subject that has special fascination for me. In my humble way, I've done a bit in that line myself. Why, when I was in the Dordogne region..."
Our talk became technical. Colonel Race's boast was not an idle one. He knew a great deal. At the same time, he made 1 or 2 curious mistakes, slips of the tongue. I might almost have thought them, but he was quick to take his cue from me and to cover them up. Once he spoke of the Mousterian period as succeeding the Ornithischian. An absurd mistake for one who knew anything of the subject. It was 12 o'clock when I went to my cabin. I was still puzzling over those queer discrepancies. Was it possible that he had got the whole subject up for the occasion? That really he knew nothing of archaeology? I shook my head, vaguely dissatisfied with that solution. Just as I was dropping off to sleep, I sat up with a sudden start as another idea flashed into my head. Had he been pumping me? Were those slight inaccuracies just tests to see whether I really knew what I was talking about? In other words, he suspected me of not being genuinely Anne Bedingfeld. Why?
Chapter 12. Extract from the diary of Sir Eustace Pedler.
There is something to be said for life on board ship. It is peaceful,
My grey hairs fortunately exempt me from the indignities of bobbing for apples, running up and down deck with potatoes and eggs, and the more painful sports of Brother Bill and Bolster Bar. What amusement people can find in these painful proceedings has always been a mystery to me. But there are many fools in the world. One praises God for their existence and keeps out of their way. Fortunately, I am an excellent sailor. Paget, poor fellow, is not. He began turning green as soon as we were out of the Solent. I presume my other so-called secretary is also seasick. At any rate, he has not yet made an appearance. But perhaps it is not seasickness, but high diplomacy. The great thing is that I have not been worried by him. On the whole, the people on board are a mangy lot. Only two decent bridge players and one decent-looking woman, Mrs. Clarence Blair. I've met her in town, of course. She is one of the only women I know who can lay claim to a sense of humour. I enjoy talking to her, and should enjoy it more if it were not for a long-legged taciturn ass who attached himself to her like a limpet. I cannot think that this Colonel Race really amuses her. He's good-looking in his way, but dull as ditchwater. One of these strong, silent men that lady novelists and young girls always rave over. Guy Paget struggled up on deck after we left Madeira and began babbling in a hollow voice about work. What the devil does anyone want to work for on board ship? It is true that I promised my publishers my reminiscences early in the summer, but what of it? Who really reads reminiscences? Old ladies in the suburbs. And what do my reminiscences amount to? I've knocked against a certain number of so-called famous people in my life. With the assistance of Paget, I invented insipid anecdotes about them, and the truth of the matter is, Paget is too honest for the job. He won't let me invent anecdotes about the people I might have met but haven't. I tried kindness with him. "You look a perfect wreck still, my dear chap," I said easily. "What you need is a deck chair in the sun. No, not another word. The work must wait." The next thing I knew, he was worrying about an extra cabin. "There's no room to work in your cabin, Sir Eustace. It's full of trunks." From his tone, you might have thought the trunks were black beetles, something that had no business to be there. I explained to him that though he might not be aware of the fact, it was usual to take a change of clothing with one when travelling. He gave me the wan smile with which he always greets my attempts at humour, and then reverted to the business in hand. "And we could hardly work in my little hole." I know Paget's little holes. He usually has the best cabin on the ship. "I'm sorry the captain didn't turn out for you this time," I said sarcastically. "Perhaps you'd like to dump some of your extra luggage in my cabin." Sarcasm is dangerous with a man like Paget. He brightened up at once. "Well, if I could get rid of the typewriter and the stationery trunk." The stationary trunk weighs several solid tons. It causes endless unpleasantness with the porters, and it is the aim of Paget's life to foist it on me. It is a perpetual struggle between us. He seems to regard it as my special personal property. I, on the other hand, regard the charge of it as the only thing where a secretary is really useful. "We'll get an extra cabin," I said hastily. The thing seemed simple enough. But Paget is a person who loves to make mysteries. He came to me the next day with a face like a Renaissance conspirator. "You know you told me to get cabin 17 for an office." "Well, what of it? Has the stationery trunk jammed in the doorway?"
"The doorways are the same size in all the cabins," replied Paget seriously. "But I tell you, Sir Eustace, there's something very queer about that cabin."
Memories of reading The Upper Berth floated through my mind. "If you mean that it's haunted," I said, "we're not going to sleep there, so I don't see what that it matters. Ghosts don't affect typewriters." Paget said that it wasn't a ghost, and that after all, he hadn't got Cabin 17. He told me a long garbled story. Apparently he and a Mr. Chichester and a girl called Bedingfeld had almost come to blows over the cabin. Needless to say, the girl had won, and Paget was apparently feeling sore over the matter.
Both 13 and 28 are better cabins, he reiterated, but they wouldn't look at them.
Well, I said, stifling a yawn, for that matter, no more would you, my dear Paget. He gave me a reproachful look.
You told me to get cabin 17.
There is a touch of the boy upon the burning deck about Paget. My dear fellow, I said testily, I mentioned number 17 because I happened to observe that it was vacant, but I didn't mean you to make a stand to the death about it. 13 or 28 would have done as equally well. He looked hurt.
There's something more, though, he insisted. Miss Bedingfield got the cabin, but this morning I saw Chichester coming out of it in a furtive sort of way.
I looked at him severely. If you're trying to get up a nasty scandal about Chichester, who is a missionary, though a perfectly poisonous person, and that attractive child Anne Bedingfeld, I don't believe a word of it, I said coldly. Anne Bedingfeld is an extremely nice girl, and particularly good legs. I should say she had far and away the best legs on board. Paget did not like my reference to Anne Bedingfeld's legs. He is the sort of man who never notices legs himself, or if he does, would die sooner than say so. Also, he thinks my appreciation of such things frivolous. I like annoying Paget, so I continued maliciously. As you've made her acquaintance, you might ask her to dine at our table tomorrow night. It's the fancy dress dance. By the way, you'd better go down to the barber and select a fancy costume for me. Surely you will not go in fancy dress, said Paget in tones of horror. I could see that it was quite incompatible with his idea of my dignity. He looked shocked and pained. I had really had no intention of donning fancy dress, but the complete discomfiture of Paget was too tempting to be forborne. What do you mean? I said. Of course I shall wear fancy dress. So will you. Paget shuddered. So go down to the barber's and see about it, I finished. I don't think you'll have any outsizes, murmured Paget, measuring my figure with his eye. Without meaning it, Paget can occasionally be extremely offensive. And order a table for six at the saloon, I said. We'll have the captain, the girl with the nice legs, Mrs. Blair.
You won't get Mrs. Blair without Colonel Race, Paget interposed. He's asked her to dine with him, I know.
Paget always knows everything. I was justifiably annoyed. Who is Race? I demanded, exasperated. As I said before, Paget always knows everything or thinks he does. He looked mysterious again. They say he's a Secret Service chap, Sir Eustace. Rather a great gun, too, but of course I don't know for certain. Isn't that like the government? I exclaimed. Here's a man on board whose business it is to carry about secret documents, and they go giving them to a peaceful outsider who only asks to be left alone.
Paget looked even more mysterious.
He came a pace nearer and dropped his voice.
If you ask me, the whole thing is very queer, Sir Eustace. Look at the illness of mine before we started.
My dear fellow, I interrupted brutally, that was a bilious attack. You're always having bilious attacks.
Paget winced slightly.
It wasn't the usual sort of bilious attack. This time, oh, for God's sake, don't go into details of your condition, Paget. I don't want to hear them.
Very well, Sir Eustace, but my belief is that I was deliberately poisoned.
Ah, I said, you've been talking to Rayburn. He did not deny it.
At any rate, Sir Eustace, he thinks so, and he should be in a position to know.
By the way, where is the chap? I asked. I've not set eyes on him since we came aboard.
He gives out that he's ill and stays in his cabin, Sir Eustace. Paget's voice dropped again. But that's camouflage, I'm sure, so that he can watch better.
Watch?
Over your safety, Sir Eustace, in case an attack should be made upon you.
You're such a cheerful fellow, Paget, I said. I trust that your imagination runs away with you. If I were you, I should go to the dance as a death's head or an executioner. It will suit your mournful style of beauty. That shut him up for the time being. I went on deck. The Bedingfeld girl was deep in conversation with the missionary parson, Chichester. Women always flutter round parsons.
A man of my figure hates stooping, but I had the courtesy to pick up a bit of paper that was fluttering round the parson's feet. I got no word of thanks for my pains. As a matter of fact, I couldn't help seeing what was written on the sheet of paper. There was just one sentence. Don't try to play a lone hand, or it will be the worse for you. That's a nice thing for a parson to have. Who is this fellow Chichester, I wonder? He looks mild as milk. But looks are deceptive. I shall ask Paget about him. Paget always knows everything. I sank gracefully into my deck chair by the side of Mrs. Blair, thereby interrupting her tete-a-tete with Race, and remarked that I didn't know what the clergy were coming to nowadays. Then I asked her to dine with me on the night of the fancy dress dance. Somehow or other, Race managed to get included in the invitation. After lunch, the Bedingfield girl came and sat with us for coffee. I was right about her legs. They are the best on the ship. I shall certainly ask her to dinner as well. I would very much like to know what mischief Faget was up to in Florence. Whenever Italy is mentioned, he goes to pieces. If I did not know how intensely respectable he is, I should suspect him of some disreputable amour. I wonder now. Even the most respectable men. It would cheer me up enormously if it was so. Paget, with a guilty secret. Splendid.
Chapter 13.
It has been a curious evening. The only costume that fitted me in the barber's emporium was that of a teddy bear. I don't mind playing bears with some nice young girls on a winter's evening in England, but it's hardly an ideal costume for the equator. However, I created a good deal of merriment and won first prize for brought on board, an absurd term for a costume hired for the evening. Still, as nobody seemed to have the least idea whether they were made or brought, it didn't matter. Mrs. Blair refused to dress up. Apparently she is at one with Paget on the matter. Colonel Race followed her example. Anne Bedingfeld had concocted a gypsy costume for herself and looked extraordinarily well. Paget said he had a headache and didn't appear. To replace him, I asked a quaint little fellow called Reeves. He's a prominent member of the South African Labour Party. Horrible little man, but I want to keep in with him as he gives me information that I need. I want to understand this Rand business from both sides. Dancing was a hot affair. I danced twice with Anne Bedingfeld, and she had to pretend she liked it. I danced once with Mrs. Blair, who didn't trouble to pretend, and I victimized various other damsels whose appearance struck me favorably. Then we went down to supper. I had ordered champagne. The steward suggested Clicquot 1911 as being the best they had on the boat, and I fell in with his suggestion. I seemed to have hit on the one thing that would loosen Colonel Race's tongue. Far from being taciturn, the man became actually talkative. For a while this amused me. Then it occurred to me that Colonel Race, and not myself, was becoming the life and soul of the party. He chafed me at length about keeping a diary. It will reveal all your indiscretions one of these days, peddler. My dear Race, I said, I venture to suggest that I am not quite the fool you think me. I may commit indiscretions, but I don't write them down in black and white. After my death, my executors will know my opinion of a great many people, but I doubt if they will find anything to add or detract from their opinion of me. A diary is useful for recording the idiosyncrasies of other people, but not one's own. There is such a thing as unconscious self-revelation, though. In the eyes of the psychoanalyst, all things are vile, I replied sententiously.
You must have had a very interesting life, Colonel Race, said Miss Bedingfeld, gazing at him with wide starry eyes.
That's how they do it, these girls. Othello charmed Desdemona by telling her stories, but oh, didn't Desdemona charm Othello by the way she listened. Anyway, the girl set Race off all right. He began to tell lion stories. A man who has shot lions in large quantities has an unfair advantage over other men. It seemed to me that it was time I, too, told a lion story, one of a more sprightly character. By the way, I remarked, that reminds me of a rather exciting tale I heard.
A friend of mine was out on a shooting trip somewhere in East Africa. One night he came out of his tent for some reason and was startled by a low growl. He turned sharply and saw a lion crouching to spring. He had left his rifle in the tent. Quick as thought, he ducked, and the lion sprang right over his head. Annoyed at having missed him, the animal growled and prepared to spring again. Again he ducked, and again the lion sprang right over him. This happened a third time, but by now he was close to the entrance of his tent, and he darted in and seized his rifle. When he emerged, rifle in hand, the lion had disappeared. That puzzled him greatly. He crept round the back of the tent, where there was a little clearing. There, sure enough, was the lion, busily practicing low jumps. This was received by a roar of applause. I drank some champagne. On another occasion, I remarked, this friend of mine had a second curious experience. He was trekking across country and being anxious to arrive at his destination before the heat of the day. He ordered his boys to inspan whilst it was still dark. They had some trouble in doing so, as the mules were very restive. But at last they managed it, and a start was made. The mules raced along like the wind, and when daylight came, they saw why. In the darkness, the boys had inspanned a lion as the near wheeler. This, too, was well received, a ripple of merriment going round the table. But I am not sure that the greatest tribute did not come from my friend, the Labour member, who remained pale and serious. "My God!" he said anxiously. "Who unharnessed them?"
"I must go to Rhodesia,"
said Mrs. Blair.
"After what you've told us, Colonel Race, I simply must. It's a horrible journey, though, 5 days in the train."
"You must join me in my private car," I said gallantly.
"Oh, Sir Eustace, how sweet of you. Do you really mean it?"
"Do I mean it?" I exclaimed reproachfully, and drank another glass of champagne.
"Just about another week, and we shall be in South Africa," sighed Mrs. Blair.
"Ah, South Africa," I said sentimentally, and began to quote from a recent speech of mine at the Colonial Institute. What has South Africa to show the world? What, indeed? Her fruit and her farms, her wool and her wattles, her herds and her hides, her gold mines and her diamonds. I was hurrying on because I knew that as soon as I paused, Reeves would butt in and inform me that the hides were worthless because the animals hung themselves on barbed wire or something of that sort, would crab everything else and end up with the hardships of the miners on the Rand. And I was not in the mood to be abused as a capitalist. However, the interruption came from another source at the magic word diamonds.
"Diamonds!" said Mrs. Blair ecstatically. "Diamonds!" breathed Miss Bedingfeld.
They both addressed Colonel Race.
"I suppose you've been to Kimberley."
I had been to Kimberley too, but I didn't manage to say so in time. Race was being inundated with questions. What were the mines like? Was it true that the natives were kept shut up in compounds and so on? Race answered their questions and showed a good knowledge of his subject. He described the methods of housing the natives the searchers instituted and the various precautions that the Beers took.
"Then it's practically impossible to steal any diamonds?" asked Mrs. Blair, with as keen an air of disappointment as though she had been journeying there for the express purpose.
"Nothing's impossible, Mrs. Blair. Thefts do occur, like the case I told you of where the Kaffir hid the stone in his wound."
"Yes, but on a large scale."
"Once, in recent years, just before the war, in fact. You must remember the case, peddler. You were in South Africa at the time." I nodded.
"Tell us," cried Mrs. Bedingfield. "Oh, do tell us."
Race smiled. "Very well. You shall have the story. I suppose most of you have heard of Sir Lawrence Eardsley, the great South African mining magnate. His mines were gold mines, but he comes into the story through his son. You may remember that just before the war, rumours were afield of a new potential Kimberley hidden somewhere in the rocky floor of the British Guiana jungles. Two young explorers,
so it was reported, had returned from that part of South America, bringing with them a remarkable collection of rough diamonds, some of them of considerable size. Diamonds of small size had been found before in the neighbourhood of the Essequibo and the Mazaruni rivers, but these two young men, John Airdsey and his friend Lucas, claimed to have discovered beds of great carbon deposits at the common head of two streams. The diamonds were of every colour, pink, blue, yellow, green, black, and the purest white. Airdsey and Lucas came to Kimberley, where they were to submit their gems to inspection. At the same time, a sensational robbery was found to have taken place at De Beers. When sending diamonds to England, they are made up into a packet. This remains in the big safe, of which the two keys are held by two different men, whilst a third man knows the combination. They are handed to the bank, and the bank send them to England. Each packet is worth roughly about £100,000. On this occasion, the bank was struck by something a little unusual about the sealing of the packet. It was opened and found to contain knobs of sugar. Exactly how suspicion came to fasten on John Airdsey, I do not know. It was remembered that he had been very wild at Cambridge and that his father had paid his debts more than once. Anyhow, it soon got about that this story of South American diamond fields was all a fantasy. John Airdsey was arrested. In his possession was found a portion of the De Beers diamonds. But the case never came to court. Sir Lawrence Airdsey paid over a sum equal to the missing diamonds, and De Beers did not prosecute. Exactly how the robbery was committed has never been known, but the knowledge that his son was a thief broke the old man's heart. He had a stroke shortly afterwards. As for John, his fate was in a way merciful. He enlisted, went to the war, fought there bravely, and was killed, thus wiping out the stain on his name. Sir Lawrence himself had a third stroke and died about a month ago. He died intestate, and his vast fortune passed to his next of kin, a man whom he hardly knew. The colonel paused. A babble of ejaculations and questions broke out. Something seemed to attract Miss Bedingfield's attention, and she turned in her chair. At the little gasp she gave, I too turned. My new secretary, Rayburn, was standing in the doorway. Under his tan, his face had the pallor of one who had seen a ghost. Evidently, Race's story had moved him profoundly. Suddenly conscious of our scrutiny, he turned abruptly and disappeared.
"Do you know who that is?"
asked Anne Bedingfield abruptly. "That's my other secretary," I explained. "Mr. Rayburn, he's been seedy up to now." She toyed with the bread on her plate.
"Has he been your secretary long?"
"Not very long," I said cautiously. But caution is useless with a woman. The more you hold back, the more she presses forward. Anne Bedingfield made no bones about it.
"How long?" she asked bluntly.
"Well, I engaged him just before I sailed. Old friend of mine recommended him." She said nothing more, but relapsed into a thoughtful silence. I turned to Race with the feeling that it was my turn to display an interest in his story. "Who is Sir Lawrence's next of kin, Race? Do you know?" "I should do so," he replied with a smile. "I am."
Chapter 14. Anne's narrative resumed.
It was on the night of the fancy dress dance that I decided that the time had come for me to confide in someone. So far I had played a lone hand and rather enjoyed it. Now suddenly everything was changed. I distrusted my own judgment, and for the first time a feeling of loneliness and desolation crept over me. I sat on the edge of my bunk, still in my gypsy dress, and considered the situation. I thought first of Colonel Race. He had seemed to like me. He would be kind, I'm sure, and he was no fool. Yet, as I thought it over, I wavered. He was a man of commanding personality. He would take the whole matter out of my hands, and it was my mystery. There were other reasons, too, which I would hardly acknowledge to myself, but which made it inadvisable to confide in Colonel Race.
Then I thought of Mrs. Blair. She too had been kind to me. I did not delude myself into the belief that that really meant anything. It was probably a mere whim of the moment. All the same, I had it in my power to interest her. She was a woman who had experienced most of the ordinary sensations in life. I proposed to supply her with an extraordinary one, and I liked her ease of manner, her lack of sentimentality, her freedom from any form of affectation. My mind was made up. I decided to seek her out then and there. She would hardly be in bed yet. Then I remembered that I did not know the number of her cabin. My friend, the night stewardess, would probably know. I rang the bell. After some delay, it was answered by a man. He gave me the information I wanted. Mrs. Blair's cabin was number 71. He apologized for the delay in answering the bell, but explained that he had all the cabins to attend to. "Where is the stewardess, then?" I asked.
"They all go off duty at 10 o'clock.
"No, I mean the night stewardess."
"No stewardess on at night, miss."
But a stewardess came the other night, about 1 o'clock.
"You must have been dreaming, miss. There's no stewardess on duty after 10.
He withdrew, and I was left to digest this morsel of information. Who was the woman who had come to my cabin on the night of the 22nd? My face grew graver as I realized the cunning and audacity of my unknown antagonists. Then, pulling myself together, I left my own cabin and sought that of Mrs. Blair. I knocked at the door. "Who's that?" called her voice from within. "It's me, Anne Bedingfeld. Oh, come in, gypsy girl." I entered. A good deal of scattered clothing lay about, and Mrs. Blair herself was draped in one of the loveliest kimonos I had ever seen. It was all orange, gold, and black, and made my mouth water to look at it. "Mrs. Blair," I said abruptly, "I want to tell you the story of my life. That is, if it isn't too late and you won't be bored." "Not a bit. I always hate going to bed," said Mrs. Blair, her face crinkling into smiles in the delightful way it had. "And I should love to hear the story of your life. You're a most unusual creature, gypsy girl. Nobody else would think of bursting in on me at 1 a.m. to tell me the story of their life, especially after snubbing my natural curiosity for weeks as you have done." "I'm not accustomed to being snubbed. It's been quite a pleasing novelty. Sit down on the sofa and unburden your soul." I told her the whole story. It took some time, as I was conscientious over all the details. She gave a deep sigh when I had finished, but she did not say at all what I had expected her to say. Instead, she looked at me, laughed a little, and said, "Do you know, Anne, you're a very unusual girl. Haven't you ever had qualms?" "Qualms?" I asked, puzzled. "Yes, qualms, qualms, qualms. Starting off alone with practically no money. What would you do when you find yourself in a strange country with all your money gone?" "It's no good bothering about that until it comes. I've got plenty of money still. The £25 that Mrs. Fleming gave me is practically intact. And then I won the sweep yesterday. That's another £15. Why, I've got lots of money, £40. "Lots of money, my God," murmured Mrs. Blair. "I couldn't do it, Anne, and I've plenty of pluck in my own way. I couldn't start off gaily with a few pounds in my pocket and no idea as to what I was doing and where I was going." "But that's the fun of it," I cried, thoroughly roused. "It gives one such a splendid feeling of adventure." She looked at me, nodded once or twice, and then smiled. "Lucky Anne, there aren't many people in the world who feel as you do." "Well," I said impatiently, "what do you think of it all, Mrs. Blair?" "I think it's the most thrilling thing I ever heard. Now, to begin with, you will stop calling me Mrs. Blair. Suzanne will be ever so much better. Is that agreed?" "I should love it, Suzanne." "Good girl. Now, let's get down to business. You say that in Sir Eustace's secretary, not that long-faced Paget, the other one, you recognised the man who was stabbed and came into your cabin for shelter." I nodded. "That gives us two links connecting Sir Eustace with the tangle. The woman was murdered in his house, and it's his secretary who gets stabbed in the mystic hour of 1 o'clock. I don't suspect Sir Eustace himself, but it can't be all coincidence. There's a connection somewhere, even if he himself is unaware of it." "Then, There's the queer business of the stewardess, she continued thoughtfully. What was she like? I hardly noticed her. I was so excited and strung up, and a stewardess seemed such an anticlimax. But yes, I did think her face was familiar. Of course, it would be if I'd seen her about the ship. Her face seemed familiar to you, said Suzanne. Sure she wasn't a man? She was very tall, I admitted. Hardly Sir Eustace, I should think not, Mr. Paget. Wait. She caught up a scrap of paper and began drawing feverishly. She inspected the result with her head poised on one side. A very good likeness of the Reverend Edward Chichester, now for the Exeteras. She passed the paper over to me. Is that your stewardess? Why, yes, I cried. Suzanne, how clever of you. She disdained the compliment with a light gesture. I've always had suspicions about that Chichester creature. Do you remember how he dropped his coffee cup and turned a sickly green when we were discussing Crippen the other day? And he tried to get Cabin 17. Yes, it all fits in so far. But what does it all mean? What was really meant to happen at 1 o'clock in Cabin 17? It can't be the stabbing of the secretary. There would be no point in timing that for a special hour on a special day in a special place. No. It must have been some kind of appointment, and he was on his way to keep it when they knifed him. But who was the appointment with? Certainly not with you. It might have been with Chichester, or it might have been with Paget. That seems unlikely, I objected. They can see each other any time. We both sat silent for a minute or two. Then Suzanne started off another tack. Could there have been anything hidden in the cabin? That seems more probable, I agreed. It would explain my things being ransacked the next morning, but there was nothing hidden there, I'm sure of it. The young man couldn't have slipped something into a drawer the night before. I shook my head. I should have seen him. Could it have been your precious bit of paper they were looking for? It might have been, but it seems rather senseless. It was only a time and a date, and they were both past by then. Suzanne nodded. That's so, of course. No, it wasn't the paper. By the way, have you got it with you? I'd rather like to see it. I brought the paper with me as Exhibit A, and I handed it over to her. She scrutinized it, frowning. There's a dot after the 17. Why isn't there a dot after the 1, too? There's a space, I pointed out. Yes, there's a space, but... Suddenly she rose and peered at the paper, holding it as close under the light as possible. There was a repressed excitement in her manner. Anne, that isn't a dot. That's a flaw in the paper. A flaw in the paper. You see? So you've got to ignore it and just go by the spaces. The spaces! I had risen and was standing by her. I read out the figures as I now saw them. 1, 71, 22. You see, said Suzanne. It's the same, but not quite. It's 1 o'clock still, and the 22nd, but it's cabin 71. My cabin, Anne. We stood staring at each other, so pleased with our new discovery and so rapt with excitement that you might have thought we had solved the whole mystery. Then I fell to earth with a bump. But, Suzanne, nothing happened here at 1 o'clock on the 22nd. Her face fell also. No, it didn't. Another idea struck me. This isn't your own cabin, is it, Suzanne? I mean, not the one you originally booked. No, the purser changed me into it. I wonder if it was booked before sailing for someone who didn't turn up. I suppose we could find out. We don't need to find out, gypsy girl, cried Suzanne. I know. The purser was telling me about it. The cabin was booked in the name of Mrs. Gray. But it seems that Mrs. Gray was merely a pseudonym for the famous Madame Nadina. She's a celebrated Russian dancer, you know. She's never appeared in London, but Paris has been quite mad about her. She had a terrific success there all through the war. A thoroughly bad lot, I believe, but most attractive. The purser expressed his regrets that she wasn't on board in a most heartfelt fashion when he gave me her cabin. And then Colonel Race told me a lot about her. It seems there were very queer stories afloat in Paris. She was suspected of espionage, but they couldn't prove anything. I rather fancy Colonel Race was over there simply on that account. He's told me some very interesting things. There was a regular organized gang, not German in origin at all. In fact, the head of it, a man always referred to as the Colonel, was thought to be an Englishman, but they never got any clue to his identity. But there is no doubt that he controlled a considerable organization of international crooks. Robberies, espionage, assaults, he undertook them all, and usually provided an innocent scapegoat to pay the penalty. Diabolically clever he must have been. This woman was supposed to be one of his agents, but they couldn't get hold of anything to go upon. Yes, Anne, we're on the right tack. Nadina is just the woman to be mixed up in this business. The appointment on the morning of the 22nd was with her in this cabin. But where is she? Why didn't she sail? A light flashed upon me. She meant to sail, I said slowly. Then why didn't she? Because she was dead. Suzanne, Nadina was the woman murdered at Marlowe. My mind went back to the bare room in the empty house, and there swept over me again the indefinable sensation of menace and evil. With it came the memory of the falling pencil and the discovery of the roll of films. A roll of films. That struck a more recent note. Where had I heard of a roll of films? And why did I connect that thought with Mrs. Blair? Suddenly, I flew at her and almost shook her in my excitement. Your films, the ones that were passed to you through the ventilator, wasn't that on the 22nd? The ones I lost? How do you know they were the same? Why would anyone return them to you that way, in the middle of the night? It's a mad idea. No, they were a message. The film had been taken out of the yellow tin case and something else put inside. Have you still got it? I may have used it. No, here it is. I remember I tossed it into the rack at the side of the bunk. She held it out to me. It was an ordinary round tin cylinder, such as films are packed in for the tropics. I took it with trembling hand, but even as I did so my heart leapt. It was noticeably heavier than it should have been. With shaking fingers, I peeled off the strip of adhesive plaster that kept it airtight. I pulled off the lid, and a stream of dull, glassy pebbles rolled onto the bed. Pebbles, I said, keenly disappointed. Pebbles? Cried Suzanne. The ring in her voice excited me. Pebbles? No, Anne, not pebbles. Diamonds!
Chapter 15.
Diamonds! I stared fascinated at the glassy heap on the bunk. I picked up one which, for the weight, might have been a fragment of broken bottle. Are you sure, Suzanne? Oh, yes, my dear. I've seen rough diamonds too often to have any doubts. They're beauties too, Anne, and some of them are unique, I should say. There's a history behind these. The history we heard tonight, I cried. You mean? Colonel Race's story. It can't be a coincidence. He told it for a purpose. To see its effect, you mean? I nodded. Its effect on Sir Eustace? Yes. But even as I said it, a doubt assailed me. Was it Sir Eustace who had been subjected to a test, or had the story been told for my benefit? I remembered the impression I had received on that former night of having been deliberately pumped. For some reason or other, Colonel Race was suspicious, but where did he come in? What possible connection could he have with the affair? Who is Colonel Race? I asked. That's rather a question, said Suzanne. He's pretty well known as a big game hunter, and as you heard him say tonight, he was a distant cousin of Sir Lawrence Eddersley. I've never actually met him until this trip. He journeys to and from Africa a good deal. There's a general idea that he does secret service work. I don't know whether it's true or not. He's certainly rather a mysterious creature. I suppose he came into a lot of money as Sir Lawrence Eddersley's heir. My dear Anne, he must be rolling. You know, he'd be a splendid match for you. I can't have a good go at him with you aboard the ship, I said, laughing. Oh, these married women. We do have a pull, murmured Suzanne complacently.
And everybody knows that I am absolutely devoted to Clarence. My husband, you know. It's so safe and pleasant to make love to a devoted wife. It must be very nice for Clarence to be married to someone like you. Well, I'm wearing to live with. Still, he can always escape to the Foreign Office, where he fixes his eyeglass in his eye and goes to sleep in a big armchair. We might cable him to tell us all he knows about race. I love sending cables, and they annoy Clarence so. He always says a letter would have done as well. I don't suppose he'd tell us anything, though. He's so frightfully discreet. That's what makes him so hard to live with for long on end. But let us go on with our matchmaking. I'm sure Colonel Race is very attracted to you, Anne. Give him a couple of glances from those wicked eyes of yours, and the deed is done. Everyone gets engaged on board ship. There's nothing else to do. I don't want to get married. Don't you? Said Suzanne. Why not? I love being married, even to Clarence. I disdained her flippancy. What I want to know is, I said with determination, what has Colonel Race got to do with this? He's in it somewhere. You don't think it was mere chance his telling that story? No, I don't, I said decidedly. He was watching us all narrowly. You remember, some of the diamonds were recovered, not all. Perhaps these are the missing ones. Or perhaps... Perhaps what? I did not answer directly. I should like to know, I said, what became of the other young man, not Erdsey, but... What was his name? Lucas. We're getting some light on the thing, anyway. It's the diamonds all these people are after. It must have been to obtain possession of the diamonds that the man in the brown suit killed Nadina. He didn't kill her, I said sharply. Of course he killed her. Who else could have done so? I don't know, but I'm sure he didn't kill her. He went into the house 3 minutes after her and came out as white as a sheet, because he found her dead. But nobody else went in. Then the murderer was in the house already. Or else he got in some other way. There's no need for him to pass the lodge. He could have climbed over the wall. Suzanne glanced at me sharply. The man in the brown suit, she mused. Who was he, I wonder? Anyway, he was identical with the doctor in the tube. He would have had time to remove his makeup and follow the woman to Marlowe. She and Carton were to have met there. They both had an order to view the same house, and if they took such elaborate precautions to make their meeting appear accidental, they must have suspected they were being followed. All the same, Carton did not know that his shadower was the man in the brown suit. When he recognized him, the shock was so great that he lost his head completely and stepped back onto the line. That all seems pretty clear, don't you think so, Anne? I did not reply. Yes, that's how it was. He took the paper from the dead man, and in his hurry to get away, he dropped it. Then he followed the woman to Marlowe. What did he do when he left there, when he had killed her? Or, according to you, found her dead? Where did he go? Still I said nothing. I wonder now, said Suzanne musingly, is it possible that he induced Sir Eustace Pedler to bring him on board as his secretary? It would be a unique chance of getting safely out of England and dodging the hue and cry. But how did he square Sir Eustace? It looks as though he had some hold over him. Or over Paget, I suggested in spite of myself. You don't seem to like Paget, Anne. Sir Eustace says he's a most capable and hard-working young man, and really he may be, for all we know, against him. Well, to continue my surmises, Rayburn is the man in the brown suit. He had read the paper he dropped. Therefore, misled by the dot, as you were, he attempts to reach cabin 17 at 1 o'clock on the 22nd, having previously tried to get possession of the cabin through Paget. On the way there, somebody knifes him. Who? I interpolated. Chichester. Yes, it all fits in. Cable to Lord Naseby that you have found the man in the brown suit and your fortune's made, Anne. There are several things you've overlooked. What things? Rayburn's got a scar, I know, but a scar can be faked easy enough. He's the right height and build. What's the description of a head with which you pulverised them at Scotland Yard? I trembled. Suzanne was a well-educated, well-read woman, but I pray that she might not be conversant with technical terms of anthropology. Dolichocephalic, I said lightly.
Suzanne looked doubtful.
Was that it?
Yes. Long-headed, you know. A head whose width is less than 75% of its length, I explained fluently. There was a pause. I was just beginning to breathe freely when Suzanne said suddenly, What's the opposite?
What do you mean, the opposite?
Well, there must be an opposite. What do you call heads whose breadth is more than 75% of their length?
Brachycephalic, I murmured unwillingly.
That's it. I thought that was what you said.
Did I?
It was a sip of the tongue. I meant golicocephalic,
I said with all the assurance I could muster.
Suzanne looked at me searchingly. Then she laughed.
You lie very well, gypsy girl, but it will save time and trouble now if you tell me all about it.
There's nothing to tell, I said unwillingly.
Isn't there? Said Suzanne gently.
I suppose I shall have to tell you, I said slowly. I'm not ashamed of it.
You can't be ashamed of something that just happens to you.
That's what he did. He was detestable, rude and ungrateful. But that I think I understand. It's like a dog that's been chained up or badly treated. It'll bite anybody. That's what he was like, bitter and snarling. I don't know why I care, but I do. I care horribly. Just seeing him has turned my whole life upside down. I love him. I want him. I'll walk all over Africa barefoot till I find him, and I'll make him care for me. I'd die for him. I'd work for him, slave for him, steal for him, even beg or borrow for him. There, now you know.
Suzanne looked at me for a long time.
You're very un-English, gypsy girl, she said at last. There's not a scrap of the sentimental about you. I've never met anyone who was at once so practical and so passionate. I shall never care for anyone like that, mercifully for me. And yet I envy you, gypsy girl. It's something to be able to care. Most people can't.
But what a mercy for your little doctor man that you didn't marry him.
He doesn't sound at all the sort of individual who would enjoy keeping high explosive in the house.
So there's to be no cabling to Lord Naseby?
I shook my head. And yet you believe him to be innocent?
I also believe that innocent people can be hanged.
Yes. But Anne, my dear, you can face facts. Face them now. In spite of all you say, he may have murdered this woman.
No, I said, he didn't.
That sentiment.
No, it isn't. He might have killed her.
He may even have followed her there with that idea in mind.
But he wouldn't take a bit of black cord and strangle her with it. If he'd done it, he would have strangled her with his bare hands. Suzanne gave a little shiver. Her eyes narrowed appreciatively.
Oh, Anne, I'm beginning to see why you find this young man of yours so attractive.
Chapter 16. I got an opportunity of tackling Colonel Race on the following morning. The auction of the sweep had just been concluded, and we walked up and down the deck together.
How's the gypsy this morning? Longing for land and her caravan?
I shook my head. Now that the sea is behaving so nicely, I feel I should like to stay on it forever and ever.
What enthusiasm!
Well, isn't it lovely this morning? We leant together over the rail. It was a glassy calm. The sea looked as though it had been oiled. There were great patches of colour on it. Blue, pale green, emerald, purple and deep orange, like a cubist picture. There was an occasional flash of silver that showed the flying fish. The air was moist and warm, almost sticky. Its breath was like a perfumed caress.
That was a very interesting story you told us last night, I said, breaking the silence.
Which one?
The one about the diamonds.
I believe women are always interested in diamonds.
Of course we are. By the way, what became of the other young man? You said there were two of them.
Young Lucas. Well, of course, they couldn't prosecute one without the other, so he went scot-free, too.
And what happened to him? Eventually, I mean. Does anyone know?
Colonel Race was looking straight ahead of him, out to sea. His face was as devoid of expression as a mask, and I had an idea that he did not like my questions. Nevertheless, he replied readily enough.
He went to war and acquitted himself bravely. He was reported missing and wounded, believed killed.
That told me what I wanted to know. I asked no more. but more than ever I wondered how much Colonel Race knew. The part he was playing in all this puzzled me. One other thing I did, that was to interview the night steward. With a little financial encouragement, I soon got him to talk.
The lady wasn't frightened, was she, miss? It seemed a harmless sort of joke. A bet, or so I understood.
I got it all out of him little by little. On the voyage from Cape Town to England, one of the passengers had handed him a roll of film with instructions that they were to be dropped onto the bunk in cabin 71 at 1 a.m. on January the 22nd on the outward journey. A lady would be occupying the cabin, and the affair was described as a bet. I gathered the steward had been liberally paid for his part in the transaction. The lady's name had not been mentioned. Of course, as Mrs. Blair went straight into cabin 71, interviewing the purser as soon as she got on board, it never occurred to the steward that she was not the lady in question. The name of the passenger who had arranged the transaction was Carton, and his description tallied exactly with that of the man killed on the tube. So one mystery, at all events, was cleared up, and the diamonds were obviously the key to the whole situation. Those last days on the Kilmorden seemed to pass very quickly. As we drew nearer and nearer to Cape Town, I was forced to consider carefully my future plans. There were so many people I wanted to keep an eye on. Mr. Chichester, Sir Eustace, and his secretary, and yes, Colonel Race. What was I to do about it? Naturally, it was Chichester who had first claim on my attention. Indeed, I was on the point of reluctantly dismissing Sir Eustace and Mr. Pageant from their position of suspicious characters when a chance conversation awakened fresh doubts in my mind. I had forgotten Mr. Paget's incomprehensible emotion at the mention of Florence. On the last evening on board, we were all sitting on deck, and Sir Eustace addressed a perfectly innocent question to his secretary. I forgot exactly what it was, something to do with railway details in Italy, but at once I noticed that Mr. Paget was displaying the same uneasiness which had caught my attention before. When Sir Eustace claimed Mrs. Blair for a dance, I quickly moved into the chair next to the secretary. I was determined to get to the bottom of the matter. "I have always longed to go to Italy," I said, "and especially to Florence. Didn't you enjoy it very much there?"
"Indeed I did, Miss Bedingfeld. If you will excuse me, there are some correspondence of Sir Eustace's that—"
I took hold of him firmly by his coat sleeve. "Oh, you mustn't run away," I cried, with the skittish accent of an elderly dowager. "I'm sure Sir Eustace wouldn't like you to leave me alone with no one to talk to. You never seem to want to talk about Florence. Oh, Mr. Paget, I believe you have a guilty secret." I still had my hand on his arm, and I could feel the sudden start he gave.
"Not at all, Miss Bedingfeld, not at all," he said earnestly. "I should be only too delighted to tell you all about it, but there really are some cables."
"Oh, Mr. Paget, what a thin pretense. I shall tell Sir Eustace." I got no further. He gave another jump. The man's nerves seemed in a shocking state.
"What is it you want to know?"
The resigned martyrdom of his tone made me smile inwardly. "Oh, everything. The pictures, the olive trees." I paused, rather at a loss myself. "I suppose you speak Italian," I resumed.
"Not a word, unfortunately. But of course, with hall porters and guides—"
"Exactly," I hastened to reply. "And which was your favourite picture?"
"Oh, the Madonna, Raphael, you know."
"Dear old Florence," I murmured sentimentally. "So picturesque on the banks of the Arno, a beautiful river. And the Duomo, you remember the Duomo?"
"Of course, of course."
"Another beautiful river, is it not?" I hazarded. "Almost more beautiful than the Arno."
"Decidedly so, I should say."
Emboldened by my success of my little trap, I proceeded further. But there was little room for doubt. Mr. Paget delivered himself into my hands with every word he uttered. The man had never been in Florence in his life. But if not in Florence, where had he been? In England? Actually, in England, at the time of the Mill House mystery. I decided on a bold step. "The curious thing is," I said, "that I fancied I had seen you before somewhere. But I must be mistaken, since you were in Florence at the time, and yet—" I studied him frankly. There was a hunted look in his eyes. He passed his tongue over dry lips.
Where?
"Did I think I had seen you?" I finished for him. "At Marlowe. You know Marlowe?" "Why, of course. How stupid of me. Sir Eustace has a house there. But with an incoherent muttered excuse, my victim rose and fled. That night, I invaded Suzanne's cabin, alight with excitement. You see, Suzanne, I urged as I finished my tale, he was in England, in Marlow, at the time of the murder. Are you so sure now that the man in the brown suit is guilty? I'm sure of one thing, Suzanne said, twinkling unexpectedly. What's that? That the man in the brown suit is better looking than poor Mr. Paget. No, Anne, don't get cross. As any teasing. Sit down here. Joking apart, I think you've made a very important discovery. Up till now, we've considered Paget as having an alibi. Now we know he hasn't. Exactly, I said. We must keep an eye on him. As well as everybody else, she said ruefully. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. That and finance. No, don't stick your nose in the air. I know you are absurdly proud and independent, but you've got to listen to horse sense over this. We're partners. I wouldn't offer you a penny because I liked you or because you're a friendless girl. What I want is a thrill, and I'm prepared to pay for it. We're going into this together, regardless of expense. To begin with, you'll come with me to the Mount Nelson Hotel at my expense, and we'll plan out our campaign. We argued the point. In the end, I gave in, but I didn't like it. I wanted to do the thing on my own. That's settled, said Suzanne at last, getting up and stretching herself with a big yawn. I'm exhausted with my own eloquence. Now then, let us discuss our victims. Mr. Chichester is going on to Durban. Sir Eustace is going to the Mount Nelson Hotel in Cape Town and then up to Rhodesia. He's going to have a private car on the railway, and in a moment of expansion, after his fourth glass of champagne the other night, he offered me a place in it. I dare say he didn't really mean it, but all the same, he can't very well back out if I hold him to it. Good, I approved. You keep an eye on Sir Eustace and Mr. Paget, and I take on Chichester. But what about Colonel Race? Suzanne looked at me queerly. Anne, you can't possibly suspect. I do. I suspect everybody. I'm in the mood when one looks round for the most unlikely person. Colonel Race is going to Rhodesia too, said Suzanne thoughtfully. If we could arrange for Sir Eustace to invite him also. You can manage it. You can manage anything. I love butter, purred Suzanne. We parted on the understanding that Suzanne should employ her talents to her best advantage. I felt too excited to go to bed immediately. It was my last night on board. Early tomorrow morning, we should be in Table Bay. I slipped up on deck. The breeze was fresh and cool. The boat was rolling a little in the choppy sea. The decks were dark and deserted. It was after midnight. I leaned over the rail, watching the fluorescent trail of foam. Ahead of us lay Africa. We were rushing towards it through the dark water. I felt alone in a wonderful world, wrapped in a strange peace. I stood there, taking no heed of time, lost in a dream. And suddenly I had a curious intimate premonition of danger. I had heard nothing, but I swung round instinctively. A shadowy form had crept up behind me. As I turned, it sprang. One hand gripped my throat, stifling any cry I might have uttered. I fought desperately, but I had no chance. I was half choking from the grip on my throat, but I bit and clung and scratched in the most approved feminine fashion. The man was handicapped by having to keep me from crying out. If he had succeeded in reaching me unawares, it would have been easy enough for him to sling me overboard with a sudden heave. The sharks would have taken care of the rest. Struggle as I would, I felt myself weakening. My assailant felt it too. He put out all his strength, and then, running on swift, noiseless feet, another shadow joined in. With one blow of his fist, he sent my opponent crashing headlong to the deck. Released, I fell back against the rail, sick and trembling. My rescuer turned to me with a quick movement.
"You're hurt."
There was something savage in his tone, a menace against the person who had dared to hurt me. Even before he spoke, I had recognized him. It was my man, the man with the scar. But that one moment in which his attention had been diverted to me, had been enough for the fallen enemy. Quick as a flash, he had risen to his feet and taken to his heels down the deck. With an oath, Rayburn sprang after him. I always hate being out of things. I joined the chase, a bad third. Round the deck, we went to the starboard side of the ship. There by the saloon door lay the man in a crumpled heap. Rayburn was bending over him. "Did you hit him again?" I called breathlessly.
"There was no need," he replied grimly. "I found him collapsed by the door. Or else he couldn't get it open and is shamming. We'll soon see about that. And we'll see who he is, too."
With a beating heart, I drew nearer. I had realized at once that my assailant was a bigger man than Chichester. Anyway, Chichester was a flabby creature who might use a knife at a pinch, but who would have little strength in his bare hands. Rayburn struck a match. We both uttered an ejaculation. The man was Guy Patchett. Rayburn appeared absolutely stupefied by the discovery.
"Paget," he muttered. "My God, Paget."
I felt a slight sense of superiority.
"You seem surprised."
"I am," he said heavily. "I never suspected."
He wheeled suddenly round on me. "And you?
You're not... You recognized him, I suppose, when he attacked you."
"No, I didn't. All the same, I am not so very surprised."
He stared at me suspiciously. "Where do you come in, I wonder? And how much do you know?"
I smiled. "A good deal, Mr. Lucas." He caught my arm. The unconscious strength of his grip made me wince.
"Where did you get that name?" he said hoarsely.
"Isn't it yours?" I demanded sweetly. "Or do you prefer to be called the man in the brown suit?" That did stagger him. He released my arm and fell back a pace or two.
"Are you a girl or a witch?" he breathed.